It is good to see everybody here this morning. As you know, this week we celebrated a national holiday, Black Friday, and Thanksgiving as well. But Black Friday is something that's been coming around every year, and it seems like it's been changing recently. I know the company that I work for, we're actually changing along with the trend. In other words, we're getting our books and our catalogs out there earlier, because people tend to be shopping a little bit earlier and not waiting for the famous Black Friday. But every Friday after Thanksgiving, I have to work. So there really is no Black Friday for me. It's just another day at work. But one of the things that I face going into work, it wasn't as bad this year, and I think that's because the trends are changing. But I face a lot of traffic. I usually drive into work, and I'm leave around 6:30, get there at 7. But the traffic is usually pretty crazy. People are kind of jockeying for position. I wouldn't even want to get within 10 miles of the outlets up in Limerick because it's just a total parking lot. You see a lot of people in a rush. One of the things that I like to do while I'm sitting at work at lunch is kind of watch YouTube videos on Black Friday of all the knock 'em, sock 'em fights over all this stupid stuff that you could probably buy for 10 bucks more the next day without getting into the fights over it. But I mean, stuff going on this year. There were people punching policemen. There was a little kid who had grabbed a strainer, some sort of steamer basket, which, I mean, why would anybody fight over that? But apparently they did. And this little kid, probably 5-6-year-old kid, had it in his hand, and some adult lady came and yanked it out of his hand. And, of course, the mother of the kid, they got into it. And it's just insane. Everybody's in such a rush, just running around, trying to get whatever they can. And, you know, I think there's times in life when being hasty, in a rush, it's okay. For instance, in my life, the times that my wife was in labor and we were trying to get to the hospital, that was okay to be in a rush. It was okay to be in a hurry in doing that. And that's a couple of stories in and of themselves. But if you're being chased, either by a criminal or by a wild animal, it's okay to be in a rush. It's okay to be in a hurry. There are times when haste is important and when haste is necessary. And yet, too many times in life, we need to actually just slow down, watch what we're doing, watch where we're going. For instance, driving. Last week, during the afternoon luncheon, we were at a table with John and Erica and Mark and Jessica, and the topic of driving came up. And we were somehow got off on who is the more aggressive, shall we say, maybe aggressive is a little too strong. Who's the one that drives a little quicker than the other ones? And hands down, it was the wives. I don't understand it. It probably wasn't always that way, but as I get older, maybe I mellow out. Maybe it's because I drive a Buick and I'm bald and everybody thinks I'm just an older fellow in the Buick. I don't know. I have to fit the profile, I guess. But when you're driving, there's times to just slow down and take it easy. Other things, like getting on planes. I did some flying last year. I want the pilot to slow down, take his time, go through all of his checklist. All right? I don't want to be hearing over the intercom halfway through the flight, whoops, forgot to check the fuel gauge or something like that. Okay, there's times to slow down. I had back surgery this year, which is why I'm sporting this great fashion look here. First time in Valley View history. Thankfully, it's not being video recorded, but and there's no visitors, so they're not offended. But I did not want my surgeon to rush through that procedure. All right, I was fine with him taking his time, slowing down, doing his best, making sure he covered all the angles. I didn't want to go back in for a follow-up. Okay, there are appropriate times to slow down. If we don't slow down, life teaches us the hard way many times that there are consequences. Speaking of driving, I'll tell on myself a little bit. Back in 2007, I was pulling out of work, and I was going to meet my wife and family for dinner. And I looked left, didn't see anyone coming. I was making a left turn. I looked right and thought, okay, well, I can sneak out here if I go. And so I went, and by the time I had made that decision, there was a guy in a Jaguar who came up, and I tagged the back end of his Jaguar. And apparently did incredible damage, not only to his vehicle at 2 miles an hour that I was going, but also to himself and to his wife, who had loss of enjoyment of spouse, and they sued me for tens of thousands of dollars. And that lawsuit went on for 7 years. It just finally got resolved last year. And so there are consequences when we don't slow down. And there are times when haste is okay, and there's times when it's not. But when we come on Sunday to worship God in his house, now I understand the people of God, I get all of that, this is just a building. But in corporate worship, when we gather together on Sundays, that is not a time for us to come in haste. It's not a time where we should come recklessly. And I've been studying the book of Ecclesiastes earlier this year. When Pastor asked me to speak, I finished up studying Ecclesiastes, and I thought, okay, well, I'll just turn the page and go on to the next book, which is the Song of Solomon. And I thought, okay, well, I probably won't preach out of that. So I thought, well, we'll go back to Ecclesiastes. And there was a passage in Ecclesiastes chapter 5. So if you would turn there, Ecclesiastes 5, where the writer of Ecclesiastes warns us about how we should approach our time of worship. And he tells us, slow down. Watch what you're doing. Because if you don't, as in many things in life, bad things are going to happen when you come to worship, if you come in haste. And if you do, you will pay a heavy price for that. And so that is our text for this morning, Ecclesiastes 5, 1 through 7. I'll read it for you. It says in verse 1, guard your steps when you go to the house of God. To draw near to listen is better than to offer the sacrifice of fools, for they don't know that they're doing evil. Be not rash with your mouth, nor let your heart be hasty to utter a word before God. For God is in heaven, and you are on earth. Therefore, let your words be few. Verse 3, for a dream comes with much busyness, and a fool's voice with many words. When you vow a vow to God, don't delay paying it, for he has no pleasure in fools. Pay what you vow. It's better that you should not vow than that you should vow and not pay. Let not your mouth lead you into sin, and do not say before the messenger that it was a mistake. Why should God be angry at your voice and destroy the work of your hands? For when dreams increase and words grow many, there is vanity. But God is the one that you must fear. So in this passage, we're reading poetry, all right? Poetry is difficult at times to understand. I'm more of a narrative person. I like a story, okay? I don't like poetry because it's hard work sometimes to figure out. I know what you said, but what did you mean, okay? So we're in poetry. It's difficult, it's challenging, but it's God's word, and it's something that we need to take some time to understand. Now, thankfully, in this passage, there is some flow to it, okay? There is some flow to it. What he does is the writer gives four admonitions that he wants us to keep in mind, and each one of those admonitions he follows with a reason. So he says, do something or don't do something, and he gives us a why, all right? So that's what we're going to look at from this text this morning. We're going to look at these four admonitions when it comes to worship, and see what the Lord has for us to learn. All right? The very first admonition found in the first verse, it starts off, it says, guard your steps when you go to the house of God. So he's giving them a command, all right? A command to guard your steps. The idea of the idea of guarding is basically to exercise great care over, all right? To watch, to be careful of. It's used to speak of personal discipline. The need to take heed in respect to one's life and one's actions. So he says, be careful. Stop for a minute. Slow down. Take a minute. Guard your steps. Exercise care over your steps. Now, he's not actually talking about physically walking, okay? He's using that as a picture, all right? So for me, I've had these surgeries recently, and I've had to be very careful in how I walk. The weekend, I think it was 2 days before my surgery was scheduled, I was outside running around like a madman trying to get a bunch of projects done because I knew once the surgery came, I wouldn't be able to do basically anything. And as a guy, I'm thinking, oh, that's great. I won't be able to do anything. Just I think I could still hold the remote for the TV, but otherwise I'm just on rest for 4 weeks. It's not as fun as it sounds, okay? So I was out there and I was trying to get everything done. And I was cutting around the corner, and we have big window wells at our house, and they're covered with these wooden frames, and they have kind of small 1x4-inch boards over them. Anyway, they're mostly decorative. So I'm cutting around the corner, trying to pull an extension cord out of an outside outlet, and I step on this thing, and bam, I go right through it. I'm sure it was because the wood was rotten, not because I was too heavy, but I just went right through it, and I slammed my shin right into this concrete, and I was like, oh, man, and it hurt, and I actually thought I broke it. Actually, maybe it was that a week or so before? I don't know. It was around the time of the surgery, and I thought that I had actually broken my shin bone. It was all swelled up. It was bad. Thankfully, I didn't, but I didn't watch my steps. I was in a hurry. I rushed and turned the corner. And boom, I wasn't watching where I was going, what I was doing. So, of course, yesterday I was outside doing some work, now that I can do a little bit more work. And I find myself, again, tempted to step on these things while I'm blowing leaves around. I'm like, did you not learn the first time? Okay? So the idea here is that the writer is saying, guard your steps. Stop, take a look. Another illustration that came to mind was there was a film that came out recently based on a true story. It's called The Walk. Now, I haven't seen the film. I'm not endorsing it or whatever. I haven't seen it. But it is based on a true story of a man named Philip Pettit, who was back in 1974. He strung a wire, about a one-inch steel wire, between the two Twin Towers in New York. And the story of how he, all the details I won't get into, but it was fascinating. How they were able to, they took like an arrow with a fish string on it and shot it between the towers. I don't think it was quite as far as me and the person there that's where everybody's sitting. It seems like a wider distance. But they shot this arrow across, and then they were able to string this cable. They were able to get support cables. And so on August, sometime in the beginning of August, he snuck up to this tower, to the top, and he stepped out on this cable that was over. And I was going to put a picture up there of what it looked like. He had a photographer up there on the roof with him taking pictures of this walk. But I didn't want to do that to you guys because some of you would have motion sickness. They said during the film some people actually got nauseous and were throwing up because it was in 3D and it was brutal. So I didn't put the picture up there. But if you can imagine in your mind stepping out on this cable and 1,350 feet up in the air. And they said that one of the things he had to do was, he was from France, he had to practice because these buildings were set to sway with the wind. And so he had to practice walking on a cable that was moving. So he strung up some cable in a field while he was still living in France, and he would walk across it while his friends would basically try and shake the cable as hard as they could to get him used to walking on something that was moving. I can't think of a better picture of somebody who watched each step carefully. I mean, not only did he walk out, but he actually laid down on his back on the cable. He got down on a knee. He talked to the pigeons. I mean, the guy, anybody to do that is probably not right in the head anyway. But it was just a fascinating story of somebody who, for no great reason, with no great reward, was very careful and watched his steps. And so the writer is telling you, when you come into the house of God, okay, back then it would have been the temple. Okay, perhaps depending on when you think the book was written, it could have been the synagogue after the temple was destroyed and the Jews dispersed. They had their own local synagogues. I won't call them churches, but it's kind of the same idea, meeting places for worship. All right? So the writer says, guard your steps. Take great care when you come into the house of God. And then, as I mentioned earlier, he gives us a reason. You say, well, why? Why do I need to do that? The reason, he says, is to draw near to listen is better than to offer the sacrifice of fools. And so a couple of times in this passage, he gives some proverbs, all right, some challenging poetry to try and understand. And he does it in the form of a better than statement, all right? So these better than statements, I'll read it again. He says, to draw near to listen is better than to offer the sacrifice of fools, all right? He's not saying vanilla ice cream is better than chocolate, all right? It's not like, well, they're both good. Just, I like this one a little bit better, all right? He's not setting it up that way. He's saying, don't do the first thing. Instead, do the second thing. So better than sounds like, well, you know, I could have cheesecake or I could have a chocolate brownie. Well, I kind of like the cheesecake better. It's not that type of a comparison. The comparison is, don't do this first thing or do this first thing and don't do the second thing, depending on how he set it up, whether he put the positive thing first or last. And so he's saying to draw near, to listen is better. The idea of drawing near is to come into the divine presence. And in this context, in this passage, he's talking about corporate public worship. And he encourages them to draw near to do what? To listen. Some people say that they all he's talking about here is just speech. In other words, just come and listen to what's being said. But I think there's more to it. I think the idea there is coming to listen with the mind of and the heart to actually obey and to do what we're being called to do. So he says to draw near to listen is better than to offer the sacrifice of fools. And writers have really struggled with this whole concept of what is the sacrifice of fools. Again, it's poetry. It doesn't say clearly what that is. But we do know that because it's described as a sacrifice of fools, and it'll be explained, they talk about sacrifices a little bit later in the passage, and we'll get to that in a couple of minutes. But we know right off the bat that whatever this sacrifice is, it is not something that we want to be offering because it's described as a sacrifice of fools. Okay? I've been called a lot of things in my life. Hopefully, none of us want to be called fools. All right? But he says here in this passage that the person who's coming in, being admonished to guard their steps, should listen instead of offering a sacrifice of fools. It could be that those were just sacrifices that did not meet the Levitical code. All right? The book of Leviticus lays out line after line after line of requirements for the sacrifices they should offer. It could be that he was offering sacrifices that involved promises, which we'll talk about in a few minutes, that were later broken. Either way, whatever it was that this man or this woman was doing when they came in to worship was being described as a sacrifice of fools. And it says in the last part of that verse, they don't know that they are doing evil. Okay? In Ecclesiastes, the idea of evil, it can certainly mean a morally wrong choice, but it also can reflect the idea of something that's disastrous or painful. They don't realize that what they're doing, how they're coming into worship, is actually leading to something that will be disastrous and painful. They're not aware of how dangerous their actions are. They're coming in, they know the steps to worship, but they're missing the essence of what worship is truly about. One author said, careless observance of ritual without any Godward movement. He's describing this phrase here, and he describes it as a careless observance of ritual without any Godward movement of the soul. It's performed out of peer pressure or habit. And so he warns them against coming to God's house this way, against coming in, and no one came into these doors this morning saying, I want to do something that's evil here today. I want to do something that's foolish. And yet these people didn't realize that as they were coming to worship, that what they were actually doing was described as a sacrifice of fools. It was described as something evil. It was described as something that would be dangerous and harmful to themselves. So his first admonishment of the four, first one is to guard your steps when you come to the house of God. The second one, starting in verse 2 and going through verse 3, says, be not rash with your mouth, nor let your heart be hasty to utter a word before God. So he starts off and he gets a little more specific as he goes along here, okay? As to giving us an idea of perhaps what he's talking about as far as this component of worship that's being treated so carelessly and so foolishly. So he narrows it down a little bit. He says, don't be rash with your mouth. Which is interesting because this comes right after a proverb, right? The better than proverb, where he says it's better to listen, okay, than it is to offer the sacrifice of fools. So he's shedding a little bit more light on what he's talking about. So we were just told, come to listen. Now in verse 2, he says, don't be rash with your mouth. The idea of being rash is to be hasty, to be quick, to be eager. And the way that the Hebrew sets it up, it has an intensive force behind it. It's not just casually speaking. It is speaking, can't think of a better way to describe it than what I just said. Quickly, rashly, hastily, without thought. The verb to be rash or to be hasty is used in other places in the Old Testament. I thought some of these were helpful in just kind of helping us get a sense of the rush to speak here. It was used in the book of Daniel a few times in the story of the fiery furnace. And the same verb is used, the same idea is used, when the king was looking into the furnace and he saw that extra fourth person there in the furnace, and it said he stood up in haste. I mean, if you can just imagine the shock, the surprise, the knee-jerk reaction, like, what in the world? I thought there were just three in here. Why are there four? Okay, so it's the same Same force, same idea as him rising in haste. Again in Daniel, it's used when the king got up in haste to run to the lion's den. He put Daniel in the lion's den, couldn't sleep all night. As soon as he could, early in the morning, he got up in haste. He rushed, he ran to see if he was there. It was used in the book of Esther when the queen's messengers went and got Haman and brought him to Esther's feast. They rushed to get him and bring him back. Okay, so it's used a number of times in the Old Testament, the idea of haste, rushed, and there's times where, again, it's okay. But when we come into the house of God, the writer warns us, don't be that way with your mouth. And when he's talking about mouth, he's talking about the things that you say, okay, your speech. Basically, don't say things that you don't mean. Things that you wouldn't say if you had taken the time to think about them first. I love this quote that I heard once. Somebody said, you know, I don't think before I speak because I like to be just as surprised as everyone else about what comes out of my mouth, all right? That's really true sometimes, you know? We don't think before we speak. And when we come into the house of God, the writer warns us against that. He warns the reader to be not rash with his mouth. He goes on, he says, don't let your heart be hasty to utter a word before God. The heart carries the idea of our mind, our emotion, our will, our intention. Excuse me. It's the thought process behind what leads us to speak. We know the scriptures say that out of the abundance of the heart, the what? The mouth speaks. All right? So he's talking first about the mouth, but he's leading on, letting us know that it's the heart that is what prompts the mouth to speak. And so we can be hasty and rash with our mouth, but that's coming from what's going on inside of our heart. We're being hasty in our heart. And the way that the Hebrew shapes up this verb is the other one showed intensity in our speech. But this actually carries the idea of a causative agent. What do I mean by that? It's saying that this haste is being caused by our hearts. It's what's inside of us that is causing us to be hasty in our speech. Our hearts have incredible potential to do harm. I mean, we live in a world where you don't have to go very far to find people who say, oh, people are good. People are pretty good people, you know? It's like, no, not really. The Bible says that our hearts are desperately wicked, and who can know it? And so our heart is like, it kind of reminds me of a sleeper cell. We've had instances, unfortunately, in the very recent past in France, where you had these people who were living in this town, living in these countries, who were just staying under the radar, who were planning, who were plotting, who were scheming to do harm, to bring destruction, to bring terror. They were sleeper cells, and they were just waiting to wreak havoc on people. And in many ways, that's kind of the way our heart is. Our heart, until we get to heaven and have a new body and we don't struggle with sin anymore, our hearts are going to have that bent toward doing what is wrong. And the writer knows that, and he warns and says, don't let your heart be hasty to utter a word before God. In other words, it's the idea of arrest your heart. Things would have been very differently in France had the police arrested these people who were plotting and intent to do harm. Had they arrested them before they were able to do that, we wouldn't be talking about the devastation that they caused. And the writer says, be aware that inside you rests a sleeper cell. Inside you rests a heart that has a bent to do wrong. It has a bent to do evil. You need to be aware that it's there. And thankfully, we know where it is. We don't have to guess, oh, is it him? We know it's inside of us. The scriptures clearly tell us that. But we need to go to the next step. And he says, arrest your heart. The idea of arresting or taking into custody, it's the same word that's used when the men were thrown in prison with Joseph. It's the same word that was used when Joseph took his brothers and he imprisoned them when they had come down to Egypt. It's the same word that's used if they found someone who was gathering sticks on the Sabbath day. That was breaking the law. They were to arrest him and take him into custody. That's how we need to view our hearts. Not with some warm, rosy, Cupid, Valentine's Day type of mentality. Our hearts are desperately wicked. Who can know it? Thankfully, as the psalmist tells us, that God is the one who can search our hearts. Search my heart. Know my ways. Try me. See if there's any wicked way in me. But the writer warns them, you have to be proactively guarding your heart. If you don't, your heart will lead you in making rash statements, and especially when we're talking about corporate worship like he is here, you're putting yourself in danger of making a mess, in danger of doing something that you will regret later. So the writer talks about that, and he again gives us a reason why. Why should we do that? Why should we not be rash with our mouth? Why should we not be hasty to let our heart lead us to just say whatever we want to say to utter before God? He says, for God is in heaven, and you are on earth. Therefore, let your words be few. So he's not just saying, okay, get your ruler out, measure, okay, God's way up. This isn't just a spatial description. So you're like, oh, yeah, heaven's way up in the sky, and I'm down here on earth. It's more than that. It's the idea of the way that they viewed the gods or God. They viewed them as dwelling in the heavens. Early on in human history, you look at the Tower of Babel. Why did they build a tower? Because they wanted to be up into the heavens where the gods were. They wanted to be godlike. And nothing changed through time. It was the same idea. People forget the difference between God and man. They forget what someone has described as the divine otherness of God. See, we come into his house to worship with his people, and in one sense, obviously the scripture teaches he is here with us, but to be here with us does not mean he is like us. And we forget that many times. We forget that, for instance, if I go to the president's house and I'm in there, well, I am in close proximity with him, but I am not like him. We are not co-equals. And it's a poor illustration, but hopefully to help understand that he needed to remember, the man coming into worship needed to remember that God is in heaven and he is on earth. He is not God's equal. He is not God's buddy or pal. He was there to worship and to remember the divine nature of God. I think of Isaiah in Isaiah chapter 6, where he saw God high and lifted up on the throne. And his response was one of awe and fear and humility. We'll talk about that a little bit more later. So he says, remember that God's in heaven and you are on earth. Therefore, let your words be few. The corrective for what he warned them about, rash words, many words, the corrective is few words, is silence, a small number of words, a small number of utterances. And in the context, as we'll see in the next verse, next admonition, the context he's talking about here is making vows, and we'll talk about that in a minute. But it's basically speech to God. What is our speech to God now? It's our prayer. It's how we talk to him. And so he warns him to remember who God is and who we are as we talk to God. He then adds a proverb in verse 3. He says, for a dream comes with much busyness, and a fool's voice with many words. And again, there was many pages written, a lot of ink spilled on trying to explain this proverb. But the thing that I found to make the most sense to me as I studied and looked at it was, if you were to rephrase this, you could say, as dreams go hand in hand with many cares, so foolish talk with many words. Or in other words, with many cares come nightmares. And with many words, you speak foolishness. Now, I tried to do a little bit of research. You know, the internet's a great place to research because you know you're getting the best information that's out there. But I tried to do a little bit of research on, you know, does worry and stress, does that actually lead to more dreams? And I think I got more confused after reading a little bit on it than I was before I started. But there is some thought out there that you dream about what happens during the day. And if you have a stressful day, anxiety during the day, that it leads to more dreams and a lot of times weirder dreams. All right, but in this proverb, regardless of what science tells us and what people who study the mind tell us, it tells us a dream comes with much business or busyness. And so just like that happens, a fool's voice, when you have many words, you know you're going to get a fool's voice. All right, so it warns, again, it all ties back into let your words be few. Because if you don't, If your words are many, as it says in the proverb, you're most likely going to get into foolish speech. And especially in the context of God's house, as we're going to see in the next admonition, it's very dangerous to behave that way. So the first admonition was to guard your steps. The second one was to not be rash with your mouth. The third admonition starts in verse 4. It says, whenever or when you vow a vow to God, do not delay in paying it. And so he talks and he gets even a little more specific, all right? Be careful when you come into God's house. Watch your speech. Don't be rash with your speech. And then he gets to a specific speech or specific things that would be said in God's house or in the tabernacle, or not the tabernacle, but in the temple or in the synagogue. And so he says, when you vow a vow to God. Now, I thought it would be helpful for us to take just a couple of minutes and talk about what a vow involves, because it is part of this passage. And I think it's important to try and, as best we can, to understand what it meant to the original reader when he was reading it, because he would have known what a vow was, and he would have known what a vow offering was. So we're going to just rabbit trail for a little bit, but it does tie back into what we're discussing with this third admonition about vowing a vow. So obviously the corporate worship for Israel involved offerings and sacrifices. All right, there were five main offerings: the burnt offering, the grain offering, sin offering, trespass offering, and peace offering. Every sacrifice that an Israelite offered was a certain type, all right, and it had a specific purpose. And we probably don't enjoy reading the book of Leviticus as much because of all the detail that's involved in how specifically those sacrifices were to be carried out. God was very specific and very detailed in that. But one of the authors that I read had a helpful quote. He said, the law prescribed the plan or the way in which every offering was to be made. Before men could follow the plan, they had to first determine the purpose. That is, they had to decide which offering they were about to make and why. Thus, there was a built-in safeguard against mindless ritual in which one went through the motions of making an offering without really thinking about what he was doing or why. The Israelite's worship was to involve his whole heart, his soul, his mind, and his strength. The precise regulations encouraged the Israelite worshiper to engage his mind in his worship. And so it's very important to remember that they didn't come and just offer the same thing every time. They had to think and specifically understand and plan for the offering that they were going to make. And so one of the offerings that they would make would be the peace offering. And the peace offering is broken up into three different type of offerings. The first one was a thanksgiving offering, the free will offering, and then an offering that was called a vow offering, the completing of a vow. So when someone made a vow to God, it involves swearing to God an oath to bind oneself with what proceeds from his mouth. Okay, so it's starting to make, hopefully, a little more sense why in the first couple of verses, the writer's saying, you better be careful what comes out of your mouth. You better not be quick to speak. He's narrowing it down for us, helping us to focus in this setting what exactly he's talking about. So he's talking about making a vow before God. The vow involves swearing an oath. An oath was basically a promise that was made. One of the biblical examples was Joshua. In Joshua chapter 9, Joshua and the men of Gibeon, you guys know the story, where the men of Gibeon came and they were afraid of Joshua. They were afraid of being destroyed. And so they lived nearby. They were next door neighbors, so to speak. But they came and deceived Joshua and made it look like they were from a far land. Like, oh, you'll never have to deal with us. We're from Timbuktu. Okay, and Joshua and the leaders responded. It says in verse 15, that Joshua made a peace. He made peace with them and made a covenant with them to let them live, which was directly in contrast of what God had told him to do. But he said, okay, well, let them live. And the leaders of the congregation swore to them. At the end of 3 days, after they had made a covenant with them, they heard that they were neighbors and that they lived among them. So they had made this oath with them. They had promised before the Lord that they would not bring them harm. But then they found out that they were nearby, they were neighbors. And so the people of Israel, when they found out that they were neighbors, in verse 17 it says, they set out and reached their cities in just 3 days. Now their cities were Gibeon and so on and so on. But the people of Israel did not attack them because the leaders of the congregation had sworn, this is the oath, they had sworn to them, the Gibeonites, by the Lord, the God of Israel. And so basically they couldn't attack them. They couldn't do what God had wanted them to do because they had sworn that they would not harm them. And it says the congregation murmured against the leaders. But all the leaders turned and said to the congregation, we have sworn to them by the Lord, the God of Israel, and now we may not touch them. This we will do to them. Let them live, lest wrath be upon us. Okay? Part of this swearing the oath was to make a promise. And if you did not keep that promise, you were putting yourself in a situation where you asked to be punished. So this oath, this promise, this vow was so sincere. You were so intent on making this and keeping this promise that if you didn't, you allowed yourself to pay the penalty, to pay the price for this. And so these leaders in Joshua's day, they didn't want to break this oath because they would in turn be bringing God's judgment upon them. So they said, we can't do this. Instead, we'll let them live, lest wrath be upon us, because of the oath that we swore to them. So it says in verse 21, the leaders said to them, let them live. So they became cutters of wood and drawers, basically slaves, just as the leaders had said of them. And so that's the idea of swearing an oath before God. A modern example is when you go into a courtroom, put your hand on the Bible, okay? I swear to tell the whole truth and nothing but the truth. That doesn't carry much sacred weight with people anymore, but there was a point in time where that did, okay? Or some people will say, I swear on my mother's grave that I'm telling the truth or that I will do whatever. Men and women could both make vows, and it usually involved giving a sacrifice or giving some money. These were not required, except for two instances on Pentecost or at the fulfillment of a Nazarite's vow. They were vows or sacrifices that were to be made above and beyond the required sacrifices. So nobody forced them to make these sacrifices. Deuteronomy 23 says, when you make a vow to the Lord your God, you must not delay in fulfilling it, for otherwise he will surely hold you accountable as a sinner. That's a pretty strong word. But it's in line with what we're reading in Ecclesiastes, where he says they don't know that they're doing evil. All right? They're a sacrifice of fools. So when you look at it in Ecclesiastes, and you go back to where it was incorporated in Deuteronomy and see that you're called a sinner if you don't keep your vow, it's like, okay, I can see where he's getting that. In verse 22, it says, if you refrain from making a vow, it will not be sinful. So you weren't required to make a vow before God. But in verse 23, it says, whatever you vow, you must be careful. Notice the sense of caution. You must be careful to do what you've promised, such as what you have vowed to the Lord your God as a freewill offering. So when they would make these vows before the Lord, swear these oaths, a lot of times they would be consecrating things to God in exchange for an answered prayer. So you see it in the one guy who's describing it as almost like a, I hate to use this because I don't mean to be irreverent, but almost the idea of a credit card transaction. So I buy now, I pay later, okay? And so these oaths, these vows that were sworn were almost, in a sense, a bargain with God. That if you do this for me, God, I will in turn offer you this. I will consecrate this to you. One of the famous vows in Scripture is the vow that Jephthah made, all right? Going off to battle, he consecrated whatever came first out of his door. And of course, we know tragically it was his daughter. But Jephthah knew better than to not keep his vow. And he did fulfill that vow. And there was a huge debate on how he actually did that, whether he actually had his daughter killed, or whether she was consecrated to temple worship or a life of celibacy, so to speak. It's not a discussion to get into today. But the point of the Jephthah vow is that he held it very seriously, what he had promised to do for God, and he kept his vow. So these vow offerings were very important once you made them, and they weren't to be made or taken lightly. So back to our text in verse 4 and 5, he says, whenever you vow a vow to God, don't delay in paying it. Okay? Notice in the last verse, haste was to be avoided, okay? In this verse, he kind of flips it on his head, says, don't be hasty to do this, but if you do make a vow, you better pay it back in the time that you're supposed to pay it. Why? What's the reason? It says, because he has no pleasure in fools. Don't delay paying your vow for any reason, because God has no pleasure in fools. And the idea of pleasure there is to feel great favor towards something. It involves an emotional attachment or involvement. It's looking at something and seeing its intrinsic value, its internal qualities. And because of those things, you value it. You have pleasure in it. In the book of Jeremiah and Hosea, the whole idea of having pleasure in something or valuing something is used to describe a broken vessel. Okay? So the writer talks about a broken vessel in which there is no pleasure. All right? There's no value in this broken vessel. All right? I told my daughter I'd put her in one illustration. So here you go, Laura. We had this bowl, just this little plastic bowl at our house. I don't remember where we got it from, how long we had it. It had a picture of a princess. I don't know if it was Cinderella or something like that. My daughter will correct me when I get home on all the how I messed up this illustration. But we know we had a bowl, and it had a princess at the bottom, all right? And this was Laura's bowl, and it really meant a lot to her. And someone in our family, who will remain nameless, ended up breaking that bowl, okay? So basically, that bowl had really no value to us anymore, all right? There was nothing, well, I can't say that totally. There was some sentimental value, okay? Because this was the bowl that we've had forever, and I'm sure the Pews are the only ones who keep things that we probably should throw away because they have sentimental value. I'm sure no one else here does that. But we have a few of those things around our house. And so even though that bowl in its broken state had no practical value for us, it wouldn't hold milk, it wouldn't hold soup, it was cracked right down the side. I mean, there was a big gash missing from it. Not even Gorilla Glue could fix it. All right, there was no value in it. But at least that had some sentimental value, and I think we finally threw it away. But what God is saying here, what the writer's saying is, if you break your vow, if you don't pay back what you've promised to God, then God has no pleasure in what he calls you as a fool. You are a fool to break your promise to God. There is nothing intrinsic that has value when it comes to a fool. There's nothing about you that God is going to see as something that he feels great favor toward. And so you're putting yourself at a huge risk. None of us want to say, oh, God has no pleasure in me. There's nothing about my life that pleases God. And yet the person who comes in, who vows a vow, who's rash with their mouth, who makes this vow but delays to pay it, God views them as a fool. He has no pleasure in what they're doing. So he starts off the verse negatively saying, don't delay in paying it. Then he throws the same thing at you another way, same message, but he says it positively. First, don't delay in paying it. Then he makes it simple. Okay, so if you're foolish enough to do this, maybe you're the type that just needs it real plain and simple. So here it is, real plain and simple. Pay what you vow. All right? Doesn't get much straighter than that. If you vowed something, committed to God, and vowed to pay him back, so to speak, to honor your commitment, then you need to pay what you vow. It's so simple, and it's to the point that even a fool can understand it. And then he puts another proverb at the end of these, verse 5. It says, it's better that you should not vow than you should vow and not pay. Another better than proverb. Again, not saying like, well, this is good, but this is good too. It's don't ever do this. Do this instead. Okay? So he says, it's better that you should not vow. That's what you should do. Just don't vow. If what you're going to do in the long run is vow and not pay. And so he warns them against doing that. And so his third admonition is to be careful when you vow to God to make sure you pay what you owe. The final admonition in verse 6 and verse 7 says, let not your mouth lead you into sin. Okay, and so kind of reflecting back on what he had talked about a few verses earlier about being rash with your mouth. He says, don't let your mouth lead you into sin. If you take those words literally, how they're written in the Hebrew, it says, don't allow your mouth to cause your body to sin. And the idea there is your words, what's going on in this passage, Your words, your rashness, your making of these vows that you don't intend to keep, that can affect your whole body. One author said, one's speech can lead one's whole person into an offense against God. So the mouth that got this fool into trouble, to begin with, is now also the same mouth that is going to try and get him out of this trouble. Because it says, let not your mouth lead you into sin, verse 6, and don't say before the messenger that it was a mistake. Okay? His words led him to problems before, and his words are going to lead him into deeper problems now. So the messenger, there's again debate. Was this a priest? Some people think it could actually be a divine presence, or it could just be the priest messenger. I think based in the context here, what's happening is that someone has made a commitment, made a vow to God, that if God does this, then he will repay God with an offering, whether it be money or a sacrifice of an animal, whatever it is. And this person has received God's blessing, and it is now time for them to pay. The last verse has said, don't delay, pay what you owe. And so the temple where they made this vow, the priests would have known. It was a public ceremony. Everybody would have known the commitment that you made, the priests especially. And if you didn't keep your commitment to God to pay back what you owe, you were putting yourself at risk. And so the priest himself or a priestly messenger would come to you and say, hey, almost like a collection agency, if you will, it's time to pay what you owe. Well, the picture here is the person comes to remind them of the debt that they owe. And instead, they say, it was a mistake. I didn't realize what I was getting into. It was an accident. It was an offense committed without knowledge or without intention. It was an inadvertent sin. I'm sure God will let me off the hook for that. God says no. In the next phrase, it says, why should God be angry at your voice, your speech, which is continually getting you into trouble? Why should God be angry at your voice and destroy the work of your hands? So people took an oath asking to be punished if they didn't fulfill their vow. And now, because they're still refusing to fulfill their vow, they're coming up with excuses. Oh, it was a mistake. I didn't really mean that. They're reneging on their commitment. They're putting themselves, as I said, in a position where God has no choice but to fulfill his part of the equation, to fulfill his part of the commitment to them, and that is to punish them. And so when you renege on doing what you've committed to do before God, you're putting yourself at risk when you break your promises. And so these people were facing destruction. We don't know exactly what the destruction of your hands looks like. It could be something, the work that they do. It could be something in the past they've done or something in the future. Either way, is not something that was desirable for this person, is not something that was going to end well for this person. They were putting themselves at risk of God's anger and God's punishment and God's correction. He closes out the section by saying, for when dreams increase and words grow many, there is vanity. And the final phrase is, but God is the one that you must fear. And I think it's really interesting because when you look at the book of Ecclesiastes, the way he closes the book is fear God and keep his commandments. And so he's carrying this theme throughout the book. He has it here in chapter 5. And he closes and summarizes his book with the emphasis on fearing God. This is a fear of both God's correction, but also a reverent fear of who God is. And he closes the book, as I said, with this advice to fear God and keep his commandments. In this context, the commandments were, when you vow a vow, fulfill it. But this person had no fear of God. They were making excuses, and God was punishing and correcting them as a result. So that's kind of what's going on in the passage, those four admonitions. For me, the struggle this week, in the last week or two, was how do I bridge that gap? All right? How do I get from one place to the next? The person who read this at the time that it was written would have understood it all about vows, about going to the temple, about seeing people who made rash vows, and that would have been very familiar to them. But how do we bridge the gap between then and now? We do worship, but it's not in the same way. I mean, we're not bringing sacrifices. I guess the Brannings bring chicken, eggs, and, well, he probably should not bring the bacon, you know, the pig stuff. But, you know, I don't think they're doing that as a sacrifice, okay? We're not bringing animals for sacrifice. But what I found was a challenge to me was that there are things that we can learn about the wrong way to do worship. There are characteristics of foolish worship in this passage that I think we can learn from. Number one, this man failed to approach worship with caution and reverence. He failed to approach with caution and reverence. Now, I'm not saying we have to come to worship with long faces, come in complete silence, men on this side, women on this side. That's not what he's talking about. You look in the Psalms, it talks over and over again how David rejoiced to come to the house of God. I mean, he was dancing and singing with joy about the privilege of coming before God. But there has to be a caution, a reverence, a guarding of our steps, as we looked at earlier. Because if we don't, we are putting ourselves in danger. There has to be a caution about what our hearts are truly like. Our hearts are deceitful, it says in that passage. They don't even know they're doing evil. And that's the scary thing, is they come thinking that what they're doing is right, and they don't even know that what they're doing is evil, is foolish, is hasty, is prideful, is displeasing. So we need to come with caution and reverence. This person also failed to approach worship with sincerity. He didn't come prepared to listen and to obey. He came to go through the motions. So he failed to use caution and reverence. He failed to approach his time of worship with sincerity. He failed to approach worship with humility. He forgot the otherness of God. The phrase, God is in heaven, you are on earth. There's a certain humility, as I mentioned earlier, talking about Isaiah. When Isaiah saw God high and lifted up on his throne, there was no room left for pride. All he could do was drop to his face and say how unworthy he was. So there needs to be humility as we approach worship. And finally, he failed to approach worship with integrity. He wasn't a person who was committed to doing what he said he would do. Instead of just not making the commitment at all, he made the commitment but did not follow through. So these were things about his foolish worship that I thought were a challenge to me as I thought about how we worship. Do we have caution, sincerity, humility, and integrity? So I'm going to close with a few questions for you just to try and help drive it home a little bit, some hopefully practical questions for each one of these ways that we approach worship. The first one is, do I approach worship with caution, with reverence? So what is my mindset when I come to worship on Sundays? I mean, the joke is, at least when we used to go to Calvary, the pastor there would often joke about this. It's like you're screaming and yelling in the car until you get there, and as soon as you pull in, it's like, how you doing? You know, everything's all smiles, and it's all good. What is our mindset as we come to this place to worship? Have we taken time to prepare our hearts and our minds for worship? Do I realize the danger that I'm putting myself in if I engage in disingenuous worship? You know, sometimes I think before the service, there's a lot of hubbub, people running around talking, and that's good. Fellowship is good. But I'm challenged at times that I think it would be wise at times to just sit and quietly pray and ask the Lord to prepare you for what you are about to do corporately as a body. I'll give you another illustration, communion. In thinking about that phrase, that phase, I'm sorry, of our worship in communion. When you look in 1 Corinthians 11, starting in verse 27, it's a passage that's familiar. We hear it on this communion Sundays. Whoever, therefore, eats the bread or drinks the cup of the Lord in an unworthy manner will be guilty concerning the body and blood of the Lord. Let a person examine himself then, and so eat the bread and drink of the cup. For anyone who eats and drinks without discerning the body eats and drinks judgment on himself. That's why many of you are weak and ill, and some have died. But if we judged ourselves truly, we would not be judged. So for instance, with communion, do we take the time to examine ourselves? Or is it just, oh, I know what we do. The guys walk up, we pray, I take the cracker, come back, they take the juice, hopefully I don't spill it, we drink, we go to ask the juice, and pray, and we're done. It's a routine, it's a ritual. And yet the scriptures warn us to approach worship with caution. Because if not, as we found in Ecclesiastes, that person is putting themselves at risk of God's judgment. And we hear that again in the passage that I just read, that God is putting us in judgment. We don't like to think about that. I don't want to think about, well, if I'm not really engaged in worship, it's no big deal. Just be like every other week where I'll go home. It's not the way that God sees it. So first of all, do we approach worship with caution? Secondly, do we approach worship with sincerity? Am I serious about what I'm here to do? Do I think about what I'm doing as I worship? Or am I simply going through the motions? Am I, in a sense, offering a sacrifice of fools? I can't answer that for you. I know for me, too many times the answer is I'm just going through the motions. See, worship is hard. It's hard to stay engaged. We were talking in Sunday school about having conversations with people, you know, how hard it is to stay engaged in a conversation, especially if you're not really interested in it. And worship is hard to stay engaged. There's so many distractions. We may not spiritually be where we need to be when it comes time to worship. But how are we listening? How well are we listening? What are we thinking about today when we prayed? Did you pray along? During the offertory, when Jess played that song, were you thinking about the words? Were you engaged in that phase of the worship? The songs that we sang, were you thinking about them? Even now, during the messages, I'm going on and on and on. I promise I'm almost done. Are you staying engaged in what God's word has to say? It takes work. It's hard. But if we don't, then we're just going through the motions. We're just checking it off the list for the week, and we're moving on. So we need to approach worship with sincerity and genuineness. Thirdly, do we approach worship with humility? As I worship, am I ever mindful of who I am worshiping? Am I focused on what is around me more than who I'm worshiping? The distractions, the cell phones going off, the kids leaving, the person behind me who can't keep on key, whatever. No offense, you guys were fine this morning. But are we focused on what's happening around us, both physically here, what's going on in our mind, or are we meditating on the otherness, the divineness, the holiness of God as we worship? I guess the question again goes back to Isaiah. Would we worship differently if we had seen what Isaiah saw? Would we worship differently if God himself was here, physically, visibly present? He, of course, is here with us where two or three are gathered. But if he was visibly, if you could see him five rows back, would we worship differently the God that we claim to love and that we claim to serve? I think we need to have a ever mindful focus on who it is that we're worshiping that will help us worship with humility. And finally, do I approach worship with integrity? Am I giving to God that which belongs to him? And we're not just talking about tithe. We're not just talking about what you put in the plate. But do we keep our commitments to God? You know, we sang a song this morning right before the message, "Take My Life and Let It Be." So as we were singing that, some of these words, "Take my life and let it be consecrated, Lord, to thee. Take my hands and let them move at the impulse of your love." Do we live our lives that way? We've just asked God to take our hands and to move them at the impulse of it. So as the Holy Spirit leads us and directs us to love and reach out to other people, we've just asked God to help us to do that. Are we just coming to listen and hear that? Or do we plan to obey? When the Holy Spirit prompts us this week, today, later on this week, to act with a spirit of love, to take those hands that he's given us and to let them move at the impulse of his love, was what we sang here just words? Or do we have any plan? Do we give any thought to living out what he challenges us to do? Verse 3 says, "Take my silver and my gold, not a mite would I withhold." That's challenging. "Take my moments, my days, let them flow in ceaseless praise," asking God to help us to live lives of praise to him. How often this week did you stop and praise God for what he's done? Well, maybe this week you did a little more because we had Thanksgiving, okay? But in a normal week, how often do we praise God? "Take my will and make it thine, it shall be no longer mine." These are many of the songs that we sing on Sundays in corporate worship. The truth in those are powerful. Can I challenge you to do something? Think about what you're saying when you sing those songs. And if you can't say that from your heart, just stand silently and pray and ask the Lord to make it so that you can pray those things to him. Because God's not just looking at those things you're saying to him as, oh, well, you know, it's pretty music. Those are our speech to God. Those are our commitments that we are making to God. And we shouldn't make commitments that we're not intending to keep. So, how would you characterize your worship? How would God characterize your worship here? You know, to those around you, they may think that you're worshiping well, but God sees our hearts. He knows our thoughts. He knows what's going on in our minds. How is he characterizing our worship? My prayer, my challenge to you this week is to think, stop, slow down. Before you come back in here, take some time to prepare yourself for what you're here to do so that our worship can be pleasing and glorifying to God. Let's pray.